It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Joe Schwartz of the School for Public Health at Harvard joins other scientists to discuss the health benefits of lower carbon emissions.
We're finding results that suggest that reducing tons of CO2 the right way, you know, has considerably more economic benefit than people may have thought previously.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. The West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals heard 8 arguments yesterday, 2 of which could have both major legal and political implications for the state. The first questions the Attorney General's ability to assist county prosecutors in criminal cases. The second questions an Election Commission decision not to allow a political party to replace a candidate on November's ballot. Ashton Mara has the details on both cases.
In their morning session, justices first heard a case that questions the West Virginia Attorney General's power. The case stems from a set of 2013 letters Attorney General Patrick Morrissey sent to the West Virginia Office of Lawyer Disciplinary Counsel. His request boiled down to this. Morrissey wants to be able to send assistant or deputy AGs to aid county prosecutors in their criminal work when requested. The disciplinary counsel says he cannot send assistants and would be creating conflict. Solicitor General Albert Lynn is Morrissey's top lawyer.
The only thing that this case concerns is whether when a particular prosecutor chooses in his or her own discretion to voluntarily ask the Attorney General for assistance, in that case, can the Attorney General, and we believe he can, send an assistant or a deputy attorney general to work temporarily?
Lynn's main argument against the council's standing is that the attorney general would be lending his employees to the county office to serve under the county prosecutor's advisement. The attorney general would not be in charge of that employee while they assisted the county and therefore would not be asserting any power. The West Virginia Constitution states the attorney general does not have any criminal prosecutorial powers, but Lynn says through common law, which the state Supreme Court has upheld in the past, the attorney general has the power to assist if requested.
The question here is not whether the attorney general, again, can independently convene a grand jury or bring an indictment or anything of that nature. The only question here is that attorney who is employed by a state agency goes and works at the invitation of a prosecutor and exercises prosecutorial power only to the extent that he or she is directed by a prosecutor.
Rachel Cipolletti heads the Office of Lawyer Disciplinary Counsel and says granting the Attorney General this kind of power exceeds the office's statutory authority and circumvents the legislative process. Chris Quaysbarth is the Assistant Prosecuting Attorney for Berkeley County and also represents the State Prosecuting Attorneys Association, who joined the Disciplinary Counsel in their opinion.
Never before in the history of this state has an Attorney General so boldly portended to have power in the area of criminal prosecution, as this Attorney General is suggesting that he has. And make no mistake, if the Attorney General has common law power to do criminal prosecution in the state, it's not to assist prosecuting attorneys. He's either got the common law power to do it, in which case he, despite what the Mr. Lynn has argued here today, he can take control of criminal prosecutions, or he doesn't.
Justice Brent Benjamin questioned if this were an issue the legislature should be deciding rather than the court, and told Lynn his argument was weak and political. At the end of their docket, justices were presented arguments over the denial of replacing a candidate on November's ballot. In August, state delegate Suzette Raines withdrew her name from the race for the 35th district in Kanawha County, citing personal reasons. Later, the Kanawha County Republican Executive Committee requested the State Election Commission allow them to appoint a replacement. The commission did accept Raines' withdrawal, but never officially voted to allow the Kanawha County Committee to replace her. Commission and Secretary of State Counsel Laura Young says they discussed it and decided the delegate withdrew without proof of extenuating personal circumstances required to pick a replacement.
I submit that the removal of the name from the ballot is a ministerial action, but that the termination of the candidacy is, at least in this particular case, was a unilateral decision taken by Delegate Raines.
Young submits there was also a Kanawha County Circuit Court order issued that required Raines to drop out of the race in order to avoid civil litigation filed against her. Even so, the Secretary of State's office removed Raines' name from the ballot without the Election Commission's vote of approval, something Young says the office does have the power to do. Now, the multi-member 35th district ballot is one Republican name short, which counsel for the Kanawha County Republican Executive Committee, Mark Carter, says is a disservice to the voters.
Your Honors, at issue in this case is whether the voters in the 35th House District will be afforded as full a ballot as possible. And that is the public policy of the state of West Virginia.
According to Carter, the statute says if a candidate withdraws from an election post-primary, the State Election Commission shall appoint a replacement. That shall, Carter says, means they are required. Therefore, the decision is an easy one for the justices to make. Should the court choose to rule in favor of the Republican Executive Committee, the ballots will have to be reprinted at the cost of the taxpayers and mailed again to absentee and military voters. That fact did not sit well with the justices, and they are expected to decide the case quickly. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:36. Some fog this morning, becoming partly cloudy today. Scattered rain in the northeastern counties. Temperatures in the 60s and 70s today. Becoming partly cloudy overnight with lows in the 40s and 50s. Partly sunny on Thursday with daytime temperatures in the 70s and low 80s. Rain and thunderstorms in our forecast on Friday.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by the New River Gorge Regional Development Authority. Working to diversify the economy in the New River Gorge region of West Virginia, serving Fayette, Nicholas, Raleigh, and Summers counties, nrgrda.org. Support for NPR comes from the George Gund Foundation, working to advance Cleveland and Northeast Ohio at gundfoundation.org.
A state economic group has calculated that 5,000 jobs have been lost in West Virginia since 2011, most of them in the state's southern coal fields. The West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy on Tuesday released its annual report, The State of Working West Virginia. The report focuses on the lingering effects of the recession and the steady erosion of coal mining jobs in southern West Virginia, among other factors. West Virginia coal production has declined by 35% since 1997, according to the report. The report offers a number of policy recommendations to increase workforce participation and take advantage of the natural gas boom in the northern part of the state. Joining us in the studio this morning is Rick Wilson with the American Friends Service Committee, which was also involved in releasing this report. Rick, good morning.
Good morning.
Get to know Mr. Microphone there and step right up there. There you are. Very good. The report is called The State of Working West Virginia, Economic Recovery and Transition in the Mountain States, Energy Economy Shifts North. Very generally, what does this report say?
Basically, this is something we do every year. We've done it since 2008, and we try to look at the latest economic trends. In this particular report, we looked at several things. One, the lingering effects of the Great Recession. We looked at the connection or disconnection between economic growth and wage and job growth. We looked at the simultaneous boom and bust in the southern coal fields and the northern gas fields. And we look at how policy decisions have impacted working people and made some recommendations in that direction, too.
So how's the state doing? These lingering effects of the recession, have we worked that out yet?
The short answer to that is there has been some job recovery, but not job quality recovery. It's been very uneven. We've seen a major loss in high-paying jobs, particularly in manufacturing, construction sector, and you've already mentioned mining. The jobs that have come back tend to be low wage and low benefit. So that's the short answer there.
How was this report researched? What went into it?
We looked at a great deal of data, census data, economic data, down to the latest news reports as things develop. So we tried to really cook down a great deal of data and figure out what the story was behind it.
How do you suppose this report will be used? Who do you want to read it? and use it?
Well, we would like for policymakers to consider it, ordinary citizens who are, we encourage to become more actively engaged in the policy process. And one thing that's encouraging, every year we make recommendations on things that could be done, and sometimes it seems like we make the same recommendations every year, which means none of them get enacted, but a few of them actually have, so that's encouraging.
Yeah, your report does say, in addition to external and internal market factors, the decisions of policymakers can have a huge impact on the economy and the quality of life for working families. Fortunately, in a democracy, this is something which ordinary working people can influence, and indeed have recently done so with some success. Can you describe what has been recently done with some success?
Actually, I think there have been a lot of successes in West Virginia lately, so I want to correct the impression that the report is a major downer. Working people and families across the state raised their voice to encourage Governor Tomlin to expand Medicaid. That's probably one of the huge policy successes. Probably around 150,000 people have gained coverage this year. These are working adults who previously didn't have it. That's a huge advantage. This year, the legislature, in a bipartisan way, overwhelmingly voted to raise the minimum wage effective January 1st. With bipartisan support, for 2 years in a row, they restored funding to vital family programs, including domestic violence, child advocacy, early childhood education. The legislature overwhelmingly passed a future fund, which is something we've advocated for a long time, so that we gain a permanent source of wealth from our natural resources. So we've expanded early childhood education.
All right. So that's a long list.
There are good things that have happened, right?
That's a long list. In talking about the transition from coal to natural gas, coal employs West Virginia workers. Natural gas drilling, we know, employs some local workers, and they're working to employ more local workers, but a lot of out-of-state workers work in that field. So how does that impact the state's economic recovery?
This was a really interesting thing to me. What we found, West Virginia led the country in some ways in economic growth and growth in state GDP over the last couple of years, but that didn't translate into a lot of job growth. A lot of that GDP increase was driven by activity in the gas fields. It just didn't compensate. In fact, one discouraging economic trend, there's kind of a disconnect between economic growth and worker productivity and job growth and wages. So that's something that used to be linked together. Mm-hmm. Today, not so much. Mm-hmm. So,
What about environmental costs? Because in both industries, there are environmental issues.
That is something in this that was beyond the scope of this report. I think that would be a vast topic, and that should be good for a great royal cat fight that one ever came out. But those are things that don't show up on the balance books of a corporation, though. In economic terms, they call them externalities, and it is a huge factor.
Right. We're about 5 weeks to a very important midterm election. Is the timing of this report meant to influence this election?
Well, this is something we do every year, year in and year out, and I actually wanted to get it out closer to Labor Day.
It's a little late then.
We're actually a little late this time around. So we do hope that these issues get considered, and a lot of the recommendations we've made are issues that people on both sides of the aisle have worked on. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest recommendations we made was that Congress provide some kind of transitional assistance for people in the coal fields, as they've done on many other occasions when there have been people displaced by trade policies or other things. And actually, Republican Congressman McKinley co-sponsored legislation with a Democratic congressman from Vermont that would do that recently. So,
and you're asking for a raise in the tobacco tax because it hasn't been raised in years.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. West Virginia, beginning in 2006, made decisions to really reform our tax system, which has reduced revenue by around $360 million last year, $425 million in this coming fiscal year. So when you take that much out and then you say it's a tough budget year, that seems like some of those wounds are self-inflicted. So raising the tobacco tax could provide revenue, could discourage young people from smoking, promote public health.
Rick Wilson with the American Friends Service Committee and the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. The report is called The State of Working West Virginia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A study released yesterday explores projected health co-benefits of reducing carbon emissions. The study indicates that each year, the lives of 50 West Virginians could be saved, but only if certain policies are adopted. Glennis Board reports.
In the wake of the Environmental Protection Agency's first ever proposed carbon pollution standards for existing power plants, scientists from Harvard, Boston, and Syracuse universities have been working on a three-part study that explores potential impacts of tightening carbon dioxide emission standards. The second report, released this week, looks specifically at human health co-benefits. The report summarizes that if high-efficiency policies like those specified by the EPA go into effect, about 3,500 people will avoid premature deaths each year throughout the lower 48 states. And the largest benefits would be experienced by populations living in the Ohio River Valley. Joel Schwartz from Harvard School of Public Health is one of the collaborators in the study.
While, as you might expect, reducing CO2 emissions can produce co-benefits by reducing emissions of other things as well, it varies a great deal how you go about doing that. So it's not automatic, and certain policy options will produce a lot more co-benefits for the same number of tons of CO2 than other ones.
When the announcement came over a year ago that there would be a program to reduce carbon emission from power plants, Syracuse University professor of civil and environmental engineering, Charles Driscoll, started to compile several different policy options that the EPA would likely pursue. Three scenarios were explored. They varied according to carbon reduction stringency, efficiency models, and compliance flexibility. The report finds that the least stringent model, which focuses on heat rate upgrades and other improvements in the operating efficiency of existing power plants, would result in little to no health benefits and could even mean increases in premature deaths each year. It's a track closest to what we more or less seem to be on now. In a 2014 report released by the American Lung Association, data indicates that while air pollution in West Virginia's metropolitan areas has generally improved, there's more ozone or smog in every county where it was measured. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection corroborates that, indicating that especially in northern counties like Marshall and Brooke, sulfur dioxide continues to be a problem because of proximity to power plants and other large industrial sources. Health risks associated with this kind of air pollution include not only respiratory problems, but also cardiovascular, neurological, developmental problems, just to name a few. The policy scenario explored that most resembles the EPA's proposed model includes state-based CO2 emission targets, flexible compliance options, and significant program investments in new end-user energy efficiency.
This isn't an argument about should I switch from burning coal to burning gas at all. This is if we replace streetlights with LED streetlights, if we encourage more energy-efficient pumps to be put in pipelines, water distribution systems, etc. If we do lots of things that promote energy efficiency, if you do it in your state, you're going to get the benefits.
Joel Schwartz from the School of Public Health at Harvard pointed out during a press conference that while study results haven't been monetized, this policy suggests redeeming economic benefits.
We're finding results that suggest that reducing tons of CO2 the right way, you know, has considerably more economic benefit than people may have thought previously.
So according to the expert scientists in Massachusetts and New York, any policy that will reduce carbon emissions is a step in the right direction environmentally. But if the EPA compromises significantly on its proposed plan, human health could continue to decline. The comment period for the EPA's proposed clean power plan has been extended to December 1st, 2014. At about the same time, the third part of this Harvard-Syracuse study investigating possible regulation standards will be released. It will explore possible benefits to ecosystems throughout the country. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.